everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I'm very excited because we meaning my pal April VVA, and I are going to do another series. And this series, I think you guys are going to enjoy. It's about the iconic love stories of classic Hollywood. And today, our first one is going to be Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. And I just want to tell you guys some exciting news because this is love week and love show that our April is going to get married next month.
I am.
I'm so
excited.
I am so happy for you. I am thrilled for you. I am totally happy.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much, Grace. I am ecstatic right now.
Yes. So during our love shows, we can get closer into her wedding and then we can get the after wedding scoop. But tell it, your love story is pretty unique. And a lot of these people had those kind of stories.
It is. How much should I share? I guess what I'm trying to figure out.
The click and boom.
Yeah, it's very much been a whirlwind thing. My fiance's name is Max. It's been a very whirlwind month, and we just decided, you know what? Like, we love each other. We think everything's great. Let's go ahead and do this. So I am getting married on March 15th. In Las Vegas at the Little Chapel of the West, which, of course, has a bunch of old Hollywood connections like Betty Grable and Zsa Zsa Gabor and Judy Garland.
And you now. Can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the most important person there.
Yes, and I want to crash. I may crash. April does not know this, but I may crash her wedding because, damn it, I belong there. Anyway.
I'm good. I'm good with you crashing my wedding.
Well, I'm like unobtrusive. I understand. I have do what you got to do. But, you know, we are also going to meet, you know, when she gets sick of her husband, I'm going to fly out to L.A. I'm kidding. She's not going to get sick of him that soon. But we'll have a couple chick days to ourselves. So that will be fun. Anyway, I thought that was a nice thing to mention, whirlwind love, on our series of iconic love stories. So congrats to our April. Yahoo.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much, Grace. I'm so happy.
And she is happy, and I'm so happy for her because I love her, and she is such a wonderful person. And you know how I am rooting for you and want only the best for you, as always. Only.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much, Grace. It means a lot.
And I mean it because it's a true story of Tinseltown. Okay. So why don't we get into our iconic love story? And we're starting with that beautiful couple, Carol Lombard and Clark Gable.
We are, and of course, their relationship sadly didn't even last 3 years because of Carol's death, but they are just one of the most iconic couples in old Hollywood history. A bit of background on, you know, their lives, I guess we could say, you know, starting with Carol. Mm-hmm. Carol was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana on October 6, 1908. She came from a relatively wealthy family, but her parents' marriage was strained. She was the third child of Elizabeth and Frederick Peters. And she was actually the only girl. And she grew up to be, you know, kind of a tomboy. There are very famous stories about Carol's ability to swear like a sailor, which she apparently picked up from her brothers, Frederick and John.
Yeah, what I love about that is that the people who loved her, they said, you know, she swore like a, you know, one of the crew, a sailor, but it wasn't gross from Carol, where it was natural. She wasn't putting it on, you know what I mean, when she said this, this, mm-hmm. this. It was the truth. So, you know, she was loved, and she swore like a, you know, like a sailor. And like you said, she learned it from her bros as being the only girl.
Yeah, and, you know, she could definitely hold her own. there are a couple of stories about Carol, you know, fighting right back as a studio executive would come on to her. She would just sit there and say, you know, put it back in your pants, basically.
Yuck, really,
although
please.
A much saltier way.
Yes.
But, you know, she kept at it. Her parents would eventually separate. They never got a divorce, but they did separate. And Carol's mom, Elizabeth, took her and the boys, and they moved to Los Angeles. And that would have been in 1914. And, of course, Carol was actually pretty quickly noticed, even though, you know, she was obviously a little baby at that point. Well, not really a baby. She would have been six. But she got noticed and everything. And I believe at 15, Charlie Chaplin offered her a screen test for his film The Gold Rush, which, of course, would come out in 1925. You know, and she was an absolutely, you know, gorgeous young woman. And then, sadly, Carol got in a car accident when she was 16. She had been signed on with Fox, and she was in a car with a friend of hers. And the car in front of them, they were stopped at a red light. The car rolled back, and it shattered the windshield, and Carol's face was permanently scarred from it. And Carol was dropped from Fox for this scar, and she thought, you know, that her career would never recover.
But the wonderful part of it was that her mother was wise enough, and plastic surgery was experimental at that time. The mother had connections, and she got a plastic surgeon. Carol had to stay awake throughout the surgery, and so she didn't move a muscle, because otherwise she would have been deformed. And he did a good enough job. You could still see the scar, but I know there was one above her eye I've never seen, and one around her lip I've never seen. But in her earlier photos, you can see, I mean, it really went in deep. But she found the perfect guy, her, you know, cameraman, who could light her perfectly. And she was still beautiful.
She was, and I, you know, and like you said, she learned lighting, she learned makeup, she really learned how to cover it. So that would have happened in 1925, and, you know, like you said, she was a real trooper through the surgery relating to that. But also, she was able to keep on working. And in 1926, she had a bit part as an extra in a movie called The Jonestown Flood. If you have ever heard of it, I don't blame you. I don't think anyone has heard of it.
I have never heard of it. No.
Yeah, no, it's not a lost film. It is still available. There is a print of it, but it really hasn't, you know, done a whole lot. But another extra on that film was Bart Gable. They didn't really have any interaction with each other. They just have, I think Carol plays, you know, like Lucy's friend number four.
Isn't that funny?
And Clark is, you know, like bar patron number seven, but they were in the film together.
I didn't know.
Their first film.
Yeah, I'm surprised, because the first one that I knew that they did was No Man of Her Own in 32. So I didn't know that they were even extras on the same film prior. So this is a newsflash for me.
You know, we always have something new come up.
I know.
We?
Newsflash.
No, so they did have that, but, you know, they weren't the focus or anything like that. They're very far down on the cast list. And of course, I guess we should probably go over Clark Gable stuff till, you know, 1926, I guess. Clark Gable was born February 1st, 1901 in Ohio. He did not come from a wealthy family like Carol. In fact, his, you know, dad had to kind of work odd jobs and everything. And Clark started to work at 13. You know, he was mechanically inclined. He worked for a tire and rubber company for a while. He worked on a farm. He worked, you know, wildcatting.
So basically,
and on the railroad.
He didn't go to high school.
Basically, no, he was just sitting there, and Clark had to work. I mean, he did come from a very poor family, and, you know, he really had to make it work.
Yeah.
But, you know, he kept on going. There are rumors, I guess, that we should kind of touch on about Clark possibly being, how would I say this? I guess a man of the night. Instead of a woman of the night, a man of the night.
What do you mean, for women, or that he was like a gigolo for men as well as women?
Yeah, there are stories. I don't really subscribe to the ones that he was going out with men. Of course, there's that whole thing about George Cukor, you know, and Clark getting him fired from Gone with the Wind because George supposedly knew his past. In all actuality, if you go through memos, David O. Selznick had wanted to fire Cukor for quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know. It's alleged, but I know he was a gigolo for women, but I just don't believe the guy thing. But could be. I mean,
yeah,
it could
that's
be.
That's
but
how I am.
I just don't know. I doubt it.
Yeah, no, I would say going with the men is probably pretty unlikely, but we do know that he went with a number of women who were quite a bit older than him. His first wife is Josephine Dillon. Josephine was 17 years older than him, and she became his manager. And they moved to Hollywood in 1924. Josephine obviously pays for his teeth to be fixed. She pays for basically the Clark Gable makeover.
And she paid for everything. She was his acting coach, and she did get him into Hollywood. And he said the marriage was never consummated. I mean, we can't know. She said it was. He said it wasn't. You know, that's a, you know, heads, tails. Who's telling the truth? I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if it wasn't consummated. Let's just put it, we'll just say that.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, you know, he's, you know, sitting there, he's, you know, basically using Josephine to get ahead.
Definitely,
but
using her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that she knew that. I don't think she was completely in the dark on it. But, you know, he finally decides, oh, you know, maybe I shouldn't be married to this woman who is significantly older than me. And he ends up divorcing Josephine in 1930, although he did admit that he owed Josephine a debt of gratitude for the training that he received from her.
Mm-hmm.
And his second wife is a Texas socialite named Rhea Langham. And they don't have the happiest marriage. Again, she is older than Clark.
I think 14 or 15 years, right?
Yeah, she is, yeah, you're about right. I think it's 14 years. Yeah, she's quite a bit older than Clark, just like Josephine was.
But she also, didn't she also, because she really helped him get that Gable look. Did the studios pay for his ears?
So the ears are a hot debate on what exactly happened with the ears. I am actually more of the opinion that it was probably a hefty use of spirit gum on a lot of it because his ears fluctuate so much. If he did get something done, I mean, they did really stick out at the beginning.
Oh, boy.
He might have gotten like something cut down a little bit on there, but for the most part, when his ears are like really flat, I would say it's probably spirit gum.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, Rhea has money, and like you said, she basically polishes up what Dillon had created.
And she also knew the social set in Hollywood as well, right?
She did. She's able to introduce Clark to, you know, hobnob with everybody. And I mean, Dillon had connections too, but she doesn't have connections like Rhea has connections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's just kind of using a woman who's older than him. But this is really when he skyrockets. This is when he becomes the king of Hollywood, is when he is married to Rhea. And as you said, Carol and Clark starred in 1932's No Man of Her Own. It's actually a pretty racy film.
It is. I mean, you know what? I didn't think they had an ounce of chemistry in that film. And I didn't like Carol in that movie. Isn't that funny? I love her. But I didn't think that they had chemistry. And I didn't like her. And as she said, we did all kinds of hot love scenes, but I never got any kind of tremble out of him. So it was just sort of like they worked together and that was it. Neither made a lasting impression on the other.
Exactly. And I mean, at this point, you know, Carol is married to William Powell. She had married him in 1931. Her marriage with Powell was, I think you could safely say it was, you know, a little bit complicated. Mm-hmm. There was a definite age difference between Powell and Lombard. And I think they, you know, cared about each other. I think that she genuinely loved him, but they couldn't make it work. And of course, Powell would go on to marry Jean Harlow. And one of the reasons reportedly he wouldn't marry Jean Harlow was because how his marriage had ended with Carol, you know, cause she was like this sexy blonde too. And she, you know, did these comedies kind of like Jean did. And, you know, supposedly he didn't want a second marriage that ended like his marriage had with Carol.
And then he married some woman who nobody knew about and didn't even know he was dating. It's kind of like a your story. They were together for 3 weeks. They got hitched. I think she was called Mousy because she was really short and whatever. And nobody knew her. She was an actress. And then she wrote a statement saying, my husband comes before my work. Well, I guess so, because you're really not getting any work, Mousy. So, but they married and they stayed married until our William Powell died. So they were married for years and years and years. I digress.
Yeah, it definitely, sometimes it just works, doesn't it?
It does. So that's something to think about. Also, I think at the time, so they were not happy, Carol and William, and I think they soon got divorced. Clark was married to Rhea, but I think he had also started his torrid affair with Joan Crawford at this point.
He had, and he and Joan would go on and off really for years until
yes.
he died.
Yeah.
His marriage with Rhea, it's very superficial, and I know that Rhea liked to claim that it was, you know, this great love affair, you know, and they were married 9 years, but it's really more so like this is a business transaction. And he goes with Joan Crawford pretty quickly after he's married to Rhea. And there's no way Rhea didn't know.
Yeah. And MGM said to him, do you want to, you get rid of Joan or you're out of here, which was basically what they told him. And he said, Joan Crawford or being a waiter. And I got rid of Joan. But they did, like you said, they continuously had, you know, within breaks, who knows, even within breaks, they consistently had friendship, sex, maybe it was a, you know, what do you call that? Friends with benefits. But I think he was kind of crazy about her in 32, and she as well.
No, and I definitely agree with that, that he was pretty crazy about Joan, but they didn't work out. And I think it kind of pales in comparison to how much he ended up loving Carol.
I agree.
But Clark definitely has issues. And then, of course, you know, like you said, Carol can't even get a tremble out of Clark. And they kind of just go their separate ways. I mean, they obviously see each other at, you know, social events and they'll talk and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, even after she divorces William Powell, I mean, she's just kind of enjoying living her life, which I can't say I blame her.
I can't. I mean, she went with Robert Riskin, who was one of the most wonderful. He wrote so many fabulous screenplays. And then she met Ross Colombo. and dumped Riskin. And Riskin didn't want to get married anyway. But he did end up marrying Fay Wray. But she met Russ Colombo, and this was quite the story. And you know what, April, have you ever heard this, that it's supposed to be off the record, but Carol said, the real love of my life was Russ Colombo?
You know, I have heard that. And there's I think a book came out not too long ago on it, Russ, and it detailed his stuff with Carol quite a bit. I think that Carol really did love Russ, and I don't know if we would have had the Gable-Lombard relationship if she had gone on with Russ and married Russ.
I believe that sometimes he died in an incredible way, and people still wonder, how the heck did that happen? Dueling pistols at his friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the pistol, I don't know, the friend had the pistol and it allegedly hit the wall and then hit Russ and he was dead. That was it. Very bizarre.
Yeah, and see, I don't know if we would have had Gable and Lombard if that hadn't happened.
I think a lot of things I read about it was that Carol felt he was very... You know, he was an Italian guy. He was very smothering. And he didn't really give her any freedom in that way. But I think when somebody, you know, like people go, the one that got away, you know, when you're older and you think about this person that got away, well, they got away for a reason. And if you stayed together, it doesn't mean that it would have worked. Like with Russ, you can... you know, he leaves so young and you're on a high with him. And then it's just sort of like, oh, he was the love of my life. But you don't know that he was the love of your life because you were only with him for a year. So, you know, I've heard other people talk about it. Victoria and Riskin talked about it, that she had read it too. But you know what? I think she was young. And I think as she grew older, I don't believe she felt that. But didn't she get a plot next to him or something in that burial place?
Yeah, supposedly she did get a plot next to Russ, but stuff like that is so hard to prove definitively. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, but no, supposedly she did get a plot, and like you said, there are people who have said that he was the love of her life. But I think it's great that you brought up how people, you know, feelings can change.
We idealize. You know. I remember when I did, as a young woman, I'm idealizing someone. And, you know, if we were together, it wouldn't have worked. It was just that I was so young. And you're not really experienced in true relationships where there's ups, downs, ins, out, you know, and you still maintain love and respect for one another when you're with each other and live with each other day in and day out, which she didn't do with him.
Exactly. It's trust me, it's very different when you live with someone, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. Lombard and Powell got divorced in 33. Russ died in 34. She did tell a screen, one of the movie magazines, Movie Screen Magazine, that she was going to marry Russ Colombo if he hadn't died. But, you know, we don't know for sure. But I do think that she would have been dedicated to Russ, you know, and I don't know. It just depends, I guess, on how it goes. It's fun to, you know, think about how this stuff could have gone.
All but
1935.
Fate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Go on, Grace.
No, I said it's all fate.
I was just going to say 1935, of course, Clark is involved in an affair with Loretta Young, who he was filming The Call of the Wild with, and she becomes pregnant with Gable's first biological child. It's a daughter. It was a little girl named Judy. She was actually born in Venice, California. And Young you know, kept her pregnancy hidden, you know, and all this stuff. And it was like this whole thing. And then when Judy was 19 months, Loretta adopted her. I'm putting that in quotes.
Yes.
And said that she just wanted to adopt a child. And then, you know, it's a pretty open secret that
Clark didn't fool anyone. Plus, she used to always, because the little girl had big ears as well. So she would put bonnets over the kid's ear. What do you think about this thing? Years after Loretta's dead, that, and they didn't, I don't know when Loretta died, but I don't know that date rape was really commonly described when she was alive. And somebody said that she said, oh, that's what happened to me with Clark. But I don't believe that, because I believe Loretta had many affairs with many of her leading men. Spencer Tracy, she wanted to marry, you know, lots of stuff. So, you know, I don't know if that's true. I just think that Loretta was dead and someone put it out there. So I don't know.
Yeah. So Young died in 2000. Judy died in 2011. And then in 2014, Loretta's son, Christopher, and his wife, Linda, come out and say that way back in 1998, Loretta told them that Judy was conceived from being, you know, raped by Clark Gable. I don't believe this story.
I don't either. I know people who are on the set and scene said that they, I mean, what are you going to do? You're in a freezing place. She's good looking. He's good looking. And she is not, you know, the sweet virginal woman. She's Catholic. But you know what? She has, you know.
She got around.
Yes. Many times, and whether they were married or not, she didn't care if she was hot for the dude. So when that came out, it kind of, you know, I didn't buy it. I don't buy it.
Yeah, I'm a very, very firm believer in this story just being a load of garbage.
Yeah, being like, oh, it's popular, came out after Me Too or something like that. And it says,
yeah,
look at Loretta and Clark, look what he did to her.
Yeah, no. And I mean, I am the first person to admit that there were some shady things going on, but I do not believe this story. I don't think that Young would have covered for Clark in her autobiography, because she, you know, says in her book, oh, we had an affair and I got pregnant. I think if she was raped, she would have said, hey, I was raped.
Once, yeah, I don't believe it. Yeah. And it's not that we're not believing the woman, because I've gotten letters before, we should always believe the woman, because you and I had said something once. It's not that we're not, we weren't there. All of a sudden, Loretta's dead, and this is what they're telling us. So, and she wrote quite the opposite. So, I don't know. I agree with you.
Yeah, no. The other thing is, I think it's pretty convenient that they wait after Judy has died to come out with it, because I think Judy would have said something about it. So, no, I absolutely do not believe that. And I know a lot of people sit there and they hate Clark Gable because of these allegations. But, I mean, you know, Loretta, you know, as you have pointed out, Loretta was known to go around and do her own thing. I guess we should say it that way.
Yes.
You know, and she was, you know, having fun doing her own thing and everything. And Clark obviously would go out and do his own thing. And it's just like, you know, I totally am one of those people who supports victims. I'm so,
Me too.
I think it's great when they come out, you know, but I also think, you know, even if Loretta said it when she was like 98 years old,
right?
You know, it's like Clark's not around to defend himself either, if that makes sense.
Yes. And like you said, you know, in her biography, she wrote that they had an affair.
Yeah. And I mean, that's even if she said it, you know, I personally don't think she said it.
Me either.
But I mean, even if she did say it, I mean, it's, you know, 38 years after Clark has died.
Right.
You know, and the other thing I find kind of weird with it too is, you remember the exact year your mom told you that? I mean, that's kind of weird.
Yes.
But, you know, that's that's what they want to claim, I mean, I guess power to them, but I do not believe those claims.
I don't either. So why don't we get to when
connection. We'll get to a happier note, I guess, huh?
Yes.
So, you know, like you said, Gable and Lombard really didn't have a whole lot of chemistry, but they did become friends. Even if it wasn't close friends, they did become friendly with each other on No Man of Her Own. And of course, there's a very famous picture of Carol presenting Clark with a ham that has his picture on it after filming wrapped
up. That's very Carol.
And Clark actually presented her a gift as well. He gave her a pair of ballerina slippers that said, "To a true prima donna." So, and this would really set the tone for how their relationship would end up being. They loved to pull gags on each other, but, you know, 1932, there's really not a whole lot going on. 4 years later, in 1936, they are both, you know, separated. Well, Carol is divorced. She's been divorced for 3 years. You know, Russ had died 2 years before, and she's just kind of, you know, living her best life as a single lady. And so Carol and Clark become reacquainted on January 25th, 1936, at the White Mayfair Ball, which was at the Victor Hugo Restaurant in Beverly Hills. Carol was actually the hostess after David O. Selznick had asked her to host the ball. And she had brought Cesar Romero as her date.
He was a wonderful escort. I bet he was a lot of fun to go out with.
He was great. All the women seem to have loved Cesar.
And then Clark came along, or did he bring somebody?
Person.
Big time.
And then Clark brought Edie Adams. She was an MGM like stable person, and she would do a lot of dubbing. She was a pretty blonde singer, and she would do a lot of dubbing for MGM stars.
I find this fascinating, this one little tidbit, because it's before Jezebel. The women are all supposed to wear white. Guess what? There was a Jezebel in the room, and her name was Norma Shearer. She wore a red dress. She was the only person that didn't follow the white dress thing. So she was a Jezebel, and it irked Carol a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't say that I blame her, but, you know, Norma knew how to make an impression, I guess, right?
Right, her husband was dead, and she was like, okay, I'm the revered widow, so I'm going to wear red and ha-ha. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was definitely a thing. And I mean, Carol was a very sensitive, nice person, and stuff like that, you know, would genuinely hurt her feelings. But of course, Carol did follow the dress code. She's in this stunning white silk dress, and it absolutely clings to her. It's absolutely gorgeous. Carol lost her date, Cesar, along the way. Of course, there's 10 million people. This dinner's $20 a plate. But this is in $1936, so it's closer to, like, oh gosh,
$300
a plate. Yes, let me think. It would be somewhere in there. It would probably be, I would say, about $300 to $400 a plate.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so, you know, it's a huge thing. And you get to hobnob with the rich and famous. But Cesar is discarded, and of course, Sir Edie is discarded. And Clark and Carol just really start dancing the night away. I mean, by all accounts, they were just basically all over each other on the dance floor.
And they had only eyes for one another, that's for sure.
They did. And it was just this instantaneous thing where they're both like, and it was just so romantic and sweet.
It really is.
You know, there's just this instantaneous connection. He invites Lombard for a ride in his new convertible. She says she has to stay because she has to take care of the party stuff. He insists, and he says, "I'll bring you back." She agrees to go, and of course, it's a whole thing because she really doesn't come back.
It's funny. It says when Gable invited her up to his hotel room, Lombard reportedly quipped, "Who do you think you are, Clark Gable?" It's so cute. And they became inseparable after.
Great?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's absolutely fabulous. I love that line. He, you know, they end up parting, you know, ways, but they just, they fall in love that night.
Yeah. And he's still married to Rhea.
He is still married to Rhea. Legally separated, still very much married to Rita. Gable awoke the next night. He's very hungover, and he looks over, and he discovers that a prank has been pulled on him because Carol had arranged for a pet store to deliver Gable a pair of doves while he was asleep.
Aw, that's a nice one.
Isn't it? It's, mm-hmm. just, it's so great. I love talking about them. You know, They would always pull these practical jokes on each other. One time, supposedly, Carol gave Clark this old beat-up Model T that she covered in paper.
Oh, I love that story. Yeah, that's a sweet.
Another. Oh, my gosh. Yes, yeah, I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, saying there throughout the ranch, they're always, you know, playing these practical jokes on each other. Like you said, they do the Model T with the big heart. Another time, supposedly, Carol arrives to a different all-white party, and she comes up in an ambulance dressed in, like, a straight jacket. I've never actually got anything to support that one, but I really love the story, and I could totally see her doing it.
I could, too.
You know, and Clark has a great sense of humor about, I mean, they really are just like this perfect, you know, happy couple. But of course, they're spending so much time together, and it really can't last forever until the newspapers start talking about it. And as you and I talked about, Grace, one of the tabloids comes out and is like, oh, you know, here's a list of couples that are supposedly just dating, but they're actually living together. And of course, Carol and Clark are on that list. She, you know, there's a push by MGM. Hey, you know, you guys better get married. So Clark divorces Rhea, and he gives her a pretty decent, you know, settlement.
What I read about him, I'm sorry, that he was tight. And a lot of that was the fact that he didn't want to pay her out so much.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, she, in his defense, she basically wanted all of his earnings.
And she had plenty of her own. And they were separated.
Exactly. So MGM, and specifically Louis B. Mayer, finally say, you know, you need to do this. You know, you guys need to get married.
They've been living together for 3 years.
Yeah. They basically move in together as soon as, you know, they start dating. And, you know, Louis Mayer's like, you guys need to stop this. You need to be respectful married people. You know, this photoplay article is just going to ruin your careers. So he agrees to give Gable a raise, and Gable agrees to give Rhea a good amount of money. And then he's also during this time filming Gone with the Wind. Rhea, though, isn't exactly ready to go away because she's comes out to the press and she said that she was humiliated by all of the articles about, you know, her, you know, ex-husband and Carol, it was soon to be ex-husband, even though he'd agreed to the settlement. And Gable, you know, sits there and he goes, well, you know, I'm just done with you. You know, here's your settlement money. Just go away, basically. And Rhea finally gets her money and she agrees to go to Reno so that she can get an expedited divorce. I wouldn't be surprised if MGM gave her a little extra money, but, you know, that's really the last we hear of Rhea with that. But, you know, Gable is filming Gone with the Wind. Of course, he plays Brett Butler. It's like this huge deal. He gets some time off and he goes and he marries Carol in Arizona.
Yeah. Otto Winkler, who is his guy, and his wife and everybody, they do this really sneaky kind of thing and they get away with it. Nobody knew that they were actually getting married there and were married.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's really genius. No one really thinks you're going to go to Arizona to marry, you know, Carol Lombard and Clark Gable.
It is. And they did it. And they got it private. Although, I think the girls, Luella and Hedda, got a little PO'd, but Carol kind of tided them over saying, we didn't even know ourselves, you know, because they were pretty vicious broads.
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, I have to give them credit for what they did. I mean, mm-hmm. that could have been like a huge thing for them too, because everyone was, you know, really tuned into what they were doing. And then, you know, their marriage for the most part, I would say, is pretty happy. They live on their farm in Encino. They continue to call each other Ma and Pa. You know, they go on a honeymoon. They're living their best life, really. And then, of course, Clark is sitting there, and he trying to think how to say this without sounding horrible. He can't always stay faithful. And there are persistent rumors about his unfaithfulness, even with Carol, even though, you know, she was the love of his life. And during 1942, he is filming Somewhere I'll Find You with Lana Turner. Now, Lana Turner is this 21-year-old, gorgeous girl.
I think it was first Honky Tonk that they had the affair, and that's what made Carol so wanting to get home fast. Yes.
Honky Tonk would have been their first movie together. Somewhere right. I'll Find You is their second movie together.
And Carol used to show up dressed to the nines.
Yeah, and she would show up on set of Honky Tonk. And, you know, because I don't blame her. I mean, I think Lana at that point would have been, what, like 20?
Yeah, Lana just Lottie Dottie and everybody. That was Lana. And Kurt and Clark, he was like he thought he was God's gift to women. And, oh, but the women throw themselves at me. How can I resist? But I do believe they had an affair on that show. And Carol would show up and she would be on the days they had their love scenes. And she would be in the line of Lana's eyes, so she saw that, and Lana would run into her dressing room and cry, and then they finally had to kick Carol out.
Yeah, it was definitely a thing, wasn't it?
And it was like unspoken with them, which I don't get. You know, to me, it really makes me feel sad that she had to go that far to go in to see her husband, and hopefully he won't be unfaithful to her. You know?
I know, you can't really imagine that, can you?
No, I can. It's so sad to me, because I know he loved her, but this is just who he was. He was like, and she just knew he loved her, and he just had sex with these other women, but ew, that would have been horrible.
Yeah, no, I can't imagine. But she's still sticks with them. Unfortunately, Carol finds out she can't have children. She's having, you know, a really hard time with that as well. You know, she always wanted to be a mom. She finds out she can't have children. But she really throws herself into the war effort. She goes and she's doing bond drives.
Yes, right she's after doing- Pearl Harbor, she was one of the first celebrities who really dug in there and traveled and did all that stuff. And she wanted Clark to enlist, and he wasn't going to enlist at that point. And they, you know, they said they had not been apart since they've been together more than 5 days. The 6 days that they were supposed to be apart during this drive was not it. But he loved her, you know, and he, but you just wonder, how can you do that to somebody you love? And is it really worth it? I mean, it's not that hot, you know what I mean? So it's, I just don't understand that kind of thing. But she did, and I'm sure it killed her and hurt her terribly. But at some point, she sort of just went with it. But that Lana thing really got her.
It did. So she's, you know, she's doing all these war drives. January 16th, 1942, she goes on Transcontinental and Western Air Flight number 3. And she's with her mother and, as you brought up earlier, Otto Winkler.
Who had had a horrible, he was Clark's, and they were best friends. And Clark had asked Otto to go, and a few days prior to them leaving, his wife said he woke up in a sweat and terrified. And he said, I dreamt I was in a plane crash. I don't want to go on a plane. And everybody told Carol. Clark even told her, don't go on a plane. But she went. They went out. And Carol took the train to Indiana and to other places. But mostly Indiana. That was her hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And she sold like over $2 million worth of war bonds.
Oh, yeah. You can't underestimate Carol's popularity.
And then when you see the sad last photos of her where she's singing the Star Spangled Banner and then the V sign, the victory. That's the last photo of her. And too much, her mother hated flying. She was into numerology. And she promised Otto as well that they would not fly. And they tossed a coin to see if they would fly
or
not.
They did. They tossed a coin and Carol won. So instead of taking the train back, they took a plane because she was worried, supposedly, reportedly, she was worried about Lana and Clark on the set of Somewhere I'll Find You.
Yeah, because they had had an argument before Carol left.
Yes, I agree. Yes, they had had an argument. Lana Turner was apparently a very hot topic. And, you know, Carol wanted to go back to Clark, and I can't say blame her. I mean, I'd probably want to go back too.
Yeah, and but the thing was, you know, they were so terrified, and she promised them prior to leaving that they were not going to take any planes. And I talked to the guy who wrote Fireball, Robert Mattson, and mm-hmm. he wrote an amazing book. And it really gets into the whole gist of this whole thing. And, yes, they both lost the draw. But it did, you know what? They kept having to stop and land again and stop and land again and stop and land again. And that would have driven me out of my mind. I don't know. That's scary, you know?
Yeah, I can't. I would have taken the train.
Yes, in those days, you know, when there were blackouts, all this stuff was going on. And but that didn't happen. So, that you know, I guess they were feeling okay. Because once they got into Las Vegas, the next hop would be L.A. But wasn't that in Las Vegas where they were kicking non-Army people off of the plane?
Yes, they kicked some people off of the plane so that Carol and her mother and Otto could sit on the plane.
They did, but first they wanted Otto, Carol, and the mother off the plane But Carol kind of threw her weight around. She threw her weight around. She even said, "Don't you know who I am?" And she said, "I just sold 2 million in war bonds, so who's more part of the war than I am?" And they just lost the argument, and Carol and her mom and poor Otto, you know, got to stay on the flight, which was weird.
Yeah, and the thing, I like that you're pointing this out. I mean, there are so many factors, but it was like if this one factor had gone through, she wouldn't have been on that flight.
Right.
Of course, the flight ended up crashing on Potosi Mountain. You can still go up there and get and find things.
Oh, my God. There's so many. Robert went up with a guide, and he almost killed himself, but he took tape of it. He took video of it, and there's still, like, really huge pieces of the plane up there. That's how difficult it is to get up there. Oh, we didn't go into this point, though. When Clark found out about the crash, they came to his house because they were going to L.A., thinking she was coming in. There's a delay. And then they took Clark, and I believe they took Otto's wife, to Las Vegas. And they brought him into some place, this hotel, the only one around. And he waited and waited and waited because people were not able to get to the plane so quickly.
Yeah, it would have been, I think them finding out was probably almost as traumatic as them actually finding out, like how they had to find out was almost as traumatic. He actually went up to the crash site to claim the bodies. And I can't imagine having to do that.
What they did, though, was tell him to go back because you do not want this to be your last memory of your wife. So he did not see her body. He did not see Otto. He did not see her mother-in-law. And how they identified Carol was by like her forehead, because they were charred and, I mean, basically blown to pieces, and a little piece, a tuft of her blonde hair, and a ruby earring that they found that they brought to Clark as well. And then they could tell him that they found Carol, they found the mom, they found Otto, and he waited until all the bodies were found, and then he took a train back with them.
I can't imagine having to do that.
I can't either. And you know, the guilt, I know Lana said, I had nothing to do, but you did tell me that there are some people in the community that think that Lana played a part in the death. You can say that in some respects, but basically, you know, she really didn't. She played a part.
Carol's own insecurities contributed to Carol's death.
Exactly. To take the everybody, MGM, Clark, everybody told her not to take the plane. And they did. And they're dead. This beautiful, vibrant woman, her mom, and poor Otto, who was terrified and had that horrifying dream the week before. And he brought him home. And Carol had asked Clark specifically after seeing the circus that Jean Harlow's funeral was, that she said, "Promise me if I die, it is quiet, it is private, nothing like this." So he did do that for her. A very low key, not a lot of people invited, not like fans, you know, eating hot dogs and Cheetos watching the event. And then Carol was put into, Carol and her mother were put into the mortuary or whatever it was, where Ross Colombo was. And Clark said, "I want her as far away from him as can be." And he felt like dirt. I can imagine he felt guilt his whole life. And I believe he loved Carol his whole life. He was devastated. He didn't care if he lived or died. He joined the Air Force.
Exactly. I mean, he never got, even Esther Williams said he just never got over it. He was never the same.
Never. And when he finally went back to the one that he was shooting, the guys couldn't believe how much he had aged, how much weight he had lost, how haggard he was. And as Robert Mattson said, that he was, you know, the smiley, flirty guy, that was gone. He became a man, and he started to have empathy and really feeling, became the man Carol actually wanted him to be. He became that mm-hmm. man. And everyone who dated him in that time said that he talked about Carol all the time and would cry. First he would start out, and then he'd have a couple drinks, and then he would cry, whatever. And I believe it was such a horrible loss for them. And I think they would have stood the test of time, as I do.
I'd like to think they would have. I think that Carol probably would have eventually got fed up if he continued cheating. But I think that they always would have loved each other. And of course, Clark is buried next to Carol at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Glendale.
Yes. Which is what he wanted. He had remarried twice after Carol. It took him 9 years to remarry, 10 years. He married that Sylvia Ashley lady, and that she was all jealous of Carol. But they both said that people did not like either of his wives because they were, you know, pretending to be like Carol. But this one, the first one, she wanted to change Carol's bedroom. She wanted to do this, and it was too, he just couldn't handle it, and they divorced very mm-hmm. quickly. And then the last wife was Kay Spreckles, who, you know, was like rough and tumble as well, trying to be like Carol. And she carried the only child he would claim that was his. And he died after at only 59 years old. But he looked a hell of a lot older.
Most definitely. He, you know, obviously he started with Marilyn, and he died, Marilyn and the Misfits in 1960, and he died, like, right after that.
And, you know, in love, in parts, of course, is our iconic love, and of course our April is in love. I'd like to think that there's somewhere that they met up again, and they had a wonderful just together, because he was childish, and he learned monogamy after, and empathy after all of this happened. So, like I said, he became the man Carol wanted, but eek, a little too late there, Clark. So, such a sad story.
It is a sad story, but they did have, you know, what, 7 years of a lot of happiness? Well, 5 years? No, yeah, 6 years, if I can get it down. They had 6 years of a lot of happiness between the two of them.
And if you see their pictures, they have so many beautiful photos of them together, and just, you know, candids, you know, as well, tons of candids. And you see that they both had a deep love for each other. And I always think of them when I think of iconic love stories. Nothing will ever change my mind that Carol and Clark were a beautiful, classic Hollywood, iconic love story. They were just a beautiful couple.
100% agree with you, Grace.
Beautiful. And our next, we are doing other people, of course. I believe our next one's going to be Bogey and Bacall. And there's some controversy involved with that one as well. and Frank and Ava, perhaps we're going to do a little Kate and Spencer Tracy. And of course, lately, there's been a little controversy about that. And our final will be Richard Burton and Elizabeth. And I know that's going to be two shows. So come along with us for our series on iconic Hollywood love stories. Right?
Right.
She's so tired, my sweetie.
Oh, no, sorry, Grace. I thought we were just doing the outro. No, I am super excited for everybody to listen to the iconic love stories that we are doing.
And as we go along, we can hear about her future, our friend April, my dear April's iconic love story in the making. So it's kind of cool. We've got the classic movie love stories, and we've got yours. Sorry, guys. Not my part, but one's better than nothing. So thank you so much as ever, my dear April, and good luck. And I'll talk to you, of course, before your marriage, because we're going to be doing this show. And thank you guys for listening, and keep listening. It's going to be a good series, wonderful people to choose, and all. You know, nobody had a perfect marriage. So we're just going to talk about the truth of True Stories of Tinseltown iconic marriages. Right, April?
That's what we're doing, Grace. As always, thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming. And I'm looking forward to doing Bogey and Bacall and all the other. And I'm so happy. Congrats, April. And for any of you else who are having lovely love stories, I'm very happy for you all. Believe me, I am. So thanks, everybody. Tune in next time. Bye. Thanks, April. Bye.
Thanks, Grace. Bye.